It was Robert, William's elder brother, who took him to the pantomime, not because he wanted to take him there, but because in a moment of weakness he had rashly promised to take him, and William had ruthlessly held him to the promise. To William, the afternoon was one of unclouded bliss. He laughed at the comedians, he cheered the hero, he hissed the villain, and he fell in love with Princess Goldilocks, the heroine. He could not help thinking that his passion was returned, for she seemed to smile directly at him, to speak to him alone. As he followed the crowd out of the theatre, he felt that all the rest of his life must be devoted to her service. During the next few days, William seemed to those around him to be strangely quiet. They could not, of course, know that in reality he was engaged on her behalf in desperate adventures, fighting armies of brigands single-handed, storming rocky strongholds, killing ferocious wild beasts. These adventures always terminated happily, and the rescued Princess Goldilocks flung herself into his arms, sobbing out her gratitude and love. Gradually, though, William began to find these adventures unconvincing. He must betake himself to the sterner stuff of real life. He decided to walk to London, make his way into her room at the theatre, and ask her to marry him at once. He would take with him as much money as he could extract from his mother. Wearing an expression of almost painful virtue, he entered the drawing-room where his mother and his sister Ethel sat over the fire doing needlework. "They say that an actress is staying at the Cedars," Ethel was saying as he entered. "The Cedars?" said Mrs. Brown, vaguely. "Yes, that place in Marley they've turned into a hotel, you know. They've been advertising it a lot, old-fashioned Christmas and that sort of thing. She goes up every day to London for the show." "Oh, what show is she in?" asked Mrs. Brown. "A pantomime, the one that Robert took William to. She is Goldilocks or something. What's the matter, William? Do you want something?" But William had vanished. He was already on his way to Marley. William knew the Cedars Hotel. He walked up its imposing drive, revolved its revolving doors, and found himself in a large hall. And here William realized suddenly that he did not even know his beloved's name. To demand to see Princess Goldilocks would merely draw down ridicule on himself. While he was cudgelling his brains for some plan of campaign, the gigantic hall porter approached him with evident disapproval. "What do you want, my boy?" he demanded sternly. An idea flashed into William's ready brain. "I've come to see someone what's staying here," he said. "Who?" said the porter. For a moment William was at a loss. He must ask for some imaginary person. Then, while he waited, he could think out his plans. But he couldn't think of a name. Suddenly a word flashed into his mind, the name of the only river in England that he'd got right in the last geography exam. "Mr. Medway," he said triumphantly. The hall porter looked over his shoulder at a man behind a desk. "Is Mr. Medway in?" he said. William's mouth dropped open in horror. I didn't mean that, Mr. Medway," he said hastily, but neither of them took any notice of him. "Yes, he came in some time ago," said the man behind the desk. He craned his neck to look down a corridor. "Here he is, coming now." Panic-stricken, William plunged back into the revolving doors. Hardly had he entered them, however, when he saw the familiar figure of Robert standing just outside the door, talking to a girl. He remembered that when Robert was in cash, he was fond of bringing his innamorata of the moment to tea at the Cedars Hotel. Hastily, he pushed the doors inward to complete the circle. By this time, however, a grim-looking man had entered the hotel hall, and the porter was talking to him, unmistakably pointing out William. With increasing panic, William pushed the door round again. Having done that, there seemed nothing for it but to go on pushing it round. One exit would bring him out to confront Robert, who by this time had seen him. The other would bring him out to confront Mr. Medway. William saw himself spending the rest of his life in the revolving doors, going round and round, till gradually he died of starvation. But someone in authority had arrived, and suddenly the door stopped. Robert, unwilling that his innamorata should learn his relationship to the young ruffian, had hastily remembered that one could get a far better tea at the village inn. William, seeing the coast clear on that side, tried to escape to it, but the powerful hand of the porter held his ear and dragged him back to the hotel foyer.
"Is this the boy who was asking for me?" said Mr. Medway.
"Yes, sir," said the porter, giving William the look of one athirst for blood.
"I suppose you're my nephew Trevor," said Mr. Medway sternly. "You arrive in a disgraceful state of untidiness, more than half an hour before the time at which I asked you to call for me. Then you make a fool of yourself and me over that door. A child in its cradle could have managed the thing better. I don't think it could, said William. I mean, if it was in its cradle, it'd have to get out to push the door, and I don't think it could.
Be quiet, said Mr. Medway testily. And come into the lounge. If there's one thing I detest, it's being the centre of a scene.
Well, you weren't, said William. I don't see how you could have been, considering it was me that was in the door.
Be quiet, snapped Mr. Medway again, leading the way into the lounge.
The porter was still directing his bloodthirsty look at William, and William could see, for the present, no alternative. He followed Mr. Medway into the lounge. Sitting down by him on a deep settee, Mr. Medway subjected him to a scrutiny that seemed to increase his disapproval.
It never occurred to you, I suppose, he said coldly, to brush your hair or wash your face or change your suit before you came to call for me?
No, said William, quite simply and without resentment.
I've not seen you for 10 years, and I certainly don't seem to have missed much. Well, how are things at home going on? How's your mother?
Very well, thank you, said William.
Very well. She told me in her last letter she was no better at all.
Yes, that's what I meant. Didn't I say that? I meant to say that.
You seem to me to be half-witted.
Yes, I am, said William, thankfully accepting this explanation. The doctor says I may get better some day, but just at present I am a bit half-witted. Mr. Medway glanced at him suspiciously.
Don't try any of your funny tricks on me, my lad. Of course, I know all your family news by letter. How's Lucy?
Well, she's very well, in a sort of way, said William guardedly. I mean, in one sort of way she's very well, and in another she isn't.
Your mother said she was quite well when she last wrote.
Yes, she is. I meant that she is quite well. She had a cold last week, that was all I meant. William could never resist embroidering a story, and memories of a cold Ethel had caught the week before came to his aid. She went to a dance and got hot dancing, and then went sitting out in the garden with the man she'd been dancing with without putting anything over her evening dress. Mr. Medway was gazing at him in bewilderment.
But Lucy's your mother's new dog, surely, he said.
William blinked. Oh, yes, of course. I didn't know you said Lucy. I thought you said some other name. I wasn't thinking what I was saying just for one minute.
You seem to me to have a misplaced sense of humour.
Yes, said William. Yeah, that's what I've got.
Well, I must say I look for a little more ordinary intelligence than a nephew of mine. Is Pongo all right?
William's spirits rose. Pongo, of course, could be nothing but a dog.
Oh, yes, he's getting on fine.
Feeding well?
Oh, yes, he has a dog biscuit every morning and some bones in the middle of the day.
Dog biscuit? Bones?
No, well, he has more than that. He has all the scraps that are left on our plates.
Dog biscuit? Scraps on plates? Is that any way to feed a 2-year-old child? Thundered Mr. Medway.
William realised that he'd made another bad break.
That was just a joke. I mean, I was thinking of Lucy.
But your mother said Lucy lived entirely on raw meat.
Yes, she does. I mean, I was thinking of the dog next door.
Mr. Medway rose abruptly.
I won't waste any more time on such rubbish. You better take me to your house now. Wait a minute, though. I really can't walk through the streets with you in such a state. You better come out to my bedroom and tidy yourself.
There seemed nothing for it but to comply. Upstairs, in a palatial bedroom, Mr. Medway turned on the washbasin taps. William, with the air of an intrepid hero facing unknown danger, plunged his face into the water, then began to scrub it vigorously. While he was engaged on this operation, there came a knock at the door, and a boy entered. He was about William's age, but startlingly different in appearance, clean and neat, the shine of his hair rivaling the shine of his shoes.
"Who are you?"
demanded Mr. Medway.
"I'm Trevor, Uncle," said the apparition.
"Good Lord. Then who's this?"
William had raised his face from the washstand and was watching them through a thick covering of soap suds.
"That's William Brown, Uncle," said Trevor. "He's a very rough boy. Mother doesn't allow me to speak to him."
The face of Mr. Medway became suffused with an angry purple. Then he started towards William. William dodged neatly and darted out of the room and along the passage. A large open hamper near the lift seemed to offer a good hiding place. He leapt into it, drawing down the lid, and waited. Soon he heard the voices of Trevor and Mr. Medway.
"Now, which way did he go? The whole thing's outrageous. I'll speak to his father most strongly, and I hope he'll punish him."
"So do I, Uncle."
"Well," said Mr. Medway, "we won't waste any more time on him. Come along, come along."
He opened the lift gate, and their voices died away. William considered his position from the darkness of the hamper. It was not reassuring. He was marooned on the second floor of a large hotel, his escape cut off by a gigantic porter who was presumably still thirsting for his blood. Suddenly he heard heavy footsteps approaching. He crouched in silence for some moments. Then suddenly he felt himself swung unceremoniously into the air.
"Oh, it's heavy, mate," said a gruff voice. "Thought it was supposed to be empty."
William, holding his head in both hands to protect it, heard the sound of a door opening and another voice saying,
"Here's the hamper, miss, and proper heavy it is, too."
"Nonsense," replied a sharp, feminine voice. "It can't be heavy. There's nothing in it. Put it down and go." With a bang, the men flung down the hamper and departed. "Catching for a tip," muttered the feminine voice indignantly. "Pretending it was heavy. What rubbish. Well, come on. We'd better get to work." "Yes, miss," said a second voice. There was a quick movement, and the lid of the hamper was thrown back. William found himself gazing up into two faces. One was evidently that of a maid. The other was that of Princess Goldilocks. But Princess Goldilocks did not look as she had looked on the stage. She looked older and less sweet. Much older and much less sweet. In fact, every trace of the radiant youth and sweetness that had so charmed William had vanished. At close quarters, she looked elderly and irritable. William noticed on a sofa a pile of theatrical clothes, which Princess Goldilocks and her maid had evidently been repairing. "What are you doing in that hamper?" said Princess Goldilocks, fixing an angry gaze upon him. William rose silently, returning her, in imagination, to the brigands and wild beasts from which he had, in imagination, so often rescued her. "I said, what were you doing in that hamper?" snapped the lady again.
"I was mending it," said William, distantly. "I was just passing and saw it wanted mending, so I got in and mended it, and then those two men came and carried it away and nearly broke my head off."
"I don't believe a word of it," said the lady furiously. "Show me where you've mended the hamper."
Just there," said William, waving his hand in a gesture that included the entire room. "You naturally can't see where it's mended, because it's mended and it looks just like the rest of it. I just finished mending it when those men came along and nearly broke my head off."
"I don't believe a word of it," said the lady again, stamping her foot. "You're a thief, that's what you are, trying to gain entry to my rooms to steal my jewels. What's the matter with your face?"
"It's half washed," explained William. "I mean, I was in the middle of washing it when something interrupted me and I had to stop."
"You look a dreadful sight. What's your name?"
"Trevor Monckton," said William promptly. "My uncle's staying in the hotel. He's called Mr. Medway. He's a very rich man. Anyway, I can't stay any longer. I'm very busy this afternoon. Goodbye."
He disappeared abruptly.
"Stop him," screamed Princess Goldilocks to her maid.
"Stop him. Heaven knows what he's taken. Quick, 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 stop him."
They both came running out after him towards the lift.
William entered it calmly, closed the gates with slow deliberation, put his tongue out at them through the bars, then pressed the ground floor button and vanished. Hysterical screams of "Stop, thief!" followed him. William emerged from the lift into the hall. The porter advanced to meet him with the air of one about to deal out a long-delayed vengeance. But when he came close to the lift, he stiffened and stood listening intently. Cries of "Stop, thief!" still floated down the lift well.
"Sounds like someone calling for help," said William, with an expression of innocent interest.
"Crikey!"
said the big porter, and pushing William aside, he leapt into the lift, pressed a button, and vanished from sight. William was out of the unguarded door like a flash of lightning. Like a flash of lightning, he shot along the road and down the field path till he reached the neighbourhood of his home. There he paused, drew breath, straightened his collar and tie, stroked back his soaped spikes of hair, assumed his most effective swagger, and, congratulating himself on having discovered the illusory nature of love before it was too late, sauntered slowly home to tea.